We go to the scriptures to find out how Paul did it, and then we try to do the same thing. And as we go through the book of Acts, we find that he did have a pattern for what he for carrying on the ministry. And so as we look at this pattern, we think, aha, that's the pattern. We'll do that, and we will be as successful as Paul. But somehow or other, it doesn't really always come out quite that way. Look at Acts chapter 17, where we find just sort of a typical chapter, Paul's approach to the ministry, and we could go to just about any chapter in the section that talks about how Paul carried on his work and find the same thing, but Acts 17 is good because it has several accounts of the same kind of approach. Starting with verse 1, Acts 17. Now when they had traveled through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And according to Paul's custom, he went to them, and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures. Now that's the approach. Go to a town, first thing he'd do, he would locate the synagogue. Then he'd go in, and then look what happened. He would explain, giving evidence that Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, and saying, "This Jesus, whom I am proclaiming to you, is the Christ." In other words, he preached the gospel. And there was always a similar result. Some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, along with a great multitude of the God-fearing Greeks and a number of the leading women. So Paul always got results. And then he always ran into trouble. But the Jews, becoming jealous and taking along some wicked men from the marketplace, formed a mob and set the city in an uproar. And coming upon the house of Jason, they were seeking to bring them out to the people. And when they did not find them, and so on and so on, he tells about the conflict that they went through. And then, verse 10, the brethren immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. In other words, what Paul did, he'd go into a town, he'd locate the synagogue, he'd go into the synagogue, and he'd split it right down the middle. It didn't bother him in the least that he was in somebody else's chicken house just robbing like crazy. It just didn't bother him at all. Now, the reason was, these people were not Christians, the people in the synagogue. And so you can't compare the synagogue with the church. We can't go into a church and do that. But Paul would go into the synagogue and he'd preach as long as he could, as long as he could stay in. He'd get kicked out, he'd take his people with him, and he'd stay there in town until he had to run for his life. And then it says, they sent him away by night to Berea. And when they arrived, this is verse 10, they laid low for a while until things blew over. No. Here's Paul, irrepressible Paul. They went into the synagogue of the Jews and started all over again, preaching until they got run out again. And then he went on to Athens. And when he got to Athens, what did he do? Verse 17. He went to the synagogue. And when he couldn't get a hearing there, or when there wasn't anything going on in the synagogue, he went into the marketplace. And then some of the philosophers came and heard what he was saying. And he says, "What is this idle babbler saying?" And one says, "He seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities." And they took him and brought him into the Greek airport here, the Areopagus, and said, "Now we would like to know this new teaching which you are proclaiming." And so he preached to them there in the Areopagus. So Paul just preached. He proclaimed. He preached at everything that moved. Any chance he got to speak the gospel, he did. And so he went on through his life until we get to Romans chapter 15, and he says a very startling thing. Here he's at the close of his career as a missionary, or near the close, and he says, verse 23. Well, let's start with verse 19. He says, I have preached the gospel in the power of the Spirit. This is Romans 15:19. So that from Jerusalem round about as far as Illyricum, I fully preached the gospel of Christ. Now, does Paul mean to tell us that from Jerusalem to Illyricum, he preached to every breathing soul? You know, Jerusalem's way down in the corner in the Bible map, and Illyricum's way up in the farthest corner, the northwest corner of the map. And Paul says, I have preached the gospel fully from Jerusalem to Illyricum. And then he says in verse 23, but now, with no further place for me in these regions, my job is done. Now, I've been wanting to come to you for years. Finally, I can. Is he trying to tell us that he evangelized every breathing soul? No. No, he's not. What did he do? Well, Paul established beachheads. That's all he did. Little nuclei of Christians. And he left it up to them to spread the gospel into the society. Now, you would think then that since Paul established beachheads, that then he would turn around and say to his apostles, or rather to his Christians, his converts, in those little nuclei, he'd say, all right, now I've gotten it started. I have the beachhead established. You carry it on and win the war. That's what a beachhead is for, isn't it? You guys, GIs, ex-GIs, you establish a beachhead for only one reason. And that is so that you can regroup, so that you can go on and occupy the enemy territory. A beachhead in itself is of no earthly good unless it is used to go on and win the war. And so Paul was a beachhead establisher. And he did this by making an assault. He just went from town to town, assaulted the city, established beachheads, and then said, okay, you guys go on and win the war. Well, then I began to look into the letters, the epistles, to find out what Paul told his members the members of his beachheads to do to go on and win the war. And I was really perplexed at what I didn't find. You'd think it would be loaded from cover to cover with exhortations. Get out there and witness. Knock on every door. Proclaim the gospel in the marketplace or to your neighbor. You know, preach the gospel. And you know, I have looked from one end of the epistles to the other, and I have not found one exhortation to that effect. Now, maybe you know of one, but I haven't found any. Now, you have things like 2 Timothy 4, where Paul says to his replacement, preach the word, be instant in season, out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort, and so on. But remember, he's talking to a man who's taking his place. And in 2 Corinthians 5, you have the statement, we are ambassadors for Christ, we beseech you in Christ's stead, be reconciled to God. But once again, he's talking about himself and his team. But remember, these beachheads consisted mainly of 8-to-5ers. People that had jobs, got up in the morning, ate breakfast, and went to work, and worked all day, and came home. That's what those beachheads consisted of. They weren't a bunch of pros. And so, his instructions to these people, the thing that struck me was that the commands to witness are just not there. And it really used to frustrate me because I prepared these messages on evangelism, and then I'd look for verses in the epistles to support what I wanted to say. And I could never come up with one that fit just what I wanted it to say. You know how it is? You have an idea and then you look to the Bible to support that idea, and rather than the other way around. You ever done that? I do all the time. But there's just nothing. Well, then it dawned on me that Paul really had a two-stage strategy. And I hope I can communicate on this because this is really fundamental and really essential. Paul's strategy of evangelizing the world consisted of two stages. The first stage was this. He made an assault to establish a beachhead. Now, as we look at the book of Acts and examine the kind of assault that Paul made and who he assaulted, we find something out that's very interesting. Where did Paul go when he went to a town? The synagogue. All right, and what did he find there in the synagogue? What did he find there in the synagogue? He found people who were either Jews or proselyte Jews, which means that those people that he spoke to had 16 centuries of preparation. They had the prophets, the Old Testament. They had a heritage. They had customs, which all of those things prepared them. And remember what Jesus said? He says, I send you to reap where you have not labored. Others have labored, and you enter into their labors. And so Paul was going in, and he was reaping a harvest that was already ripe, that had been ripened by centuries of preparation at the hand of God. And so he was encountering people who, with a presentation of the gospel, could grasp it, understand it, and truly be converted. But the fact is that Paul never had to face the same challenge that the members of his beachhead had to face. They were in cities like Corinth, Ephesus, cities that are famous to this day for their corruption, for their immorality. Ephesus was the place, Anthony and Cleopatra, the goddess Diana, idolatry, wealth, luxury, totally an amoral and immoral society. They didn't go to the synagogue. The people in Ephesus and the people in Corinth didn't have the benefit of 16 centuries of preparation. They were just purely pagan. And so Paul knew that to just go to them and say, okay, now press the assault, knock on every door, he knew that that wouldn't work. Because it takes more than that to reach a person who does not have the Christian background. It takes this. It takes the exposure of a life. Now we find that it's all over the epistles. And one of the key passages on this is in Titus chapter 2. Take a look at this. And when I first saw this, my eyes just about fell out of my head. Because then it all comes together. Titus chapter 2. And here Paul has advice for everybody. And if you're alive and breathing, you find yourself in this chapter. He starts out, verse 2, Titus chapter 2. Older men, got that? Are to be temperate, dignified, sensible, sound in faith, in love, perseverance. And then he goes on and he says, older women likewise are to be reverent in their behavior, not malicious gossips. And he describes how the older women should be, that they may encourage the younger women to love their husbands, love their children, to be sensible, pure. He's talking about lifestyle here. It's a thing that we heard in the testimonies tonight. Their lifestyle was changed. Their relationships were changed because they encountered Christ. Why? Why is that so important? Look at the last phrase of verse 5. That the word of God may not be dishonored. Among whom? Who is he really concerned about? Well, he's concerned about the world. See, it's important that your relationship be enriched by your Christianity, because most relationships are in desperate repair. And then he goes on and he talks to the young men, that they should be, describes how they should be. Why? Verse 8, the last phrase. That the opponent may be put to shame, having nothing bad to say about us. And once again, he talks about, okay, watch your lifestyle. Watch what you say, what you do, the way you live, because the opponent can be put to shame that way. Once again, he's talking about thinking about influence in the world. Then he goes on, And he talks about employees or bond slaves. Be subject to your own masters and everything. To be well pleased, not argumentative, and so on and so on. And the last phrase in verse 10, why? That they may adorn the doctrine of God our Savior in every respect. And so once again, the emphasis in the epistles is on the kind of life you lead for the sake of the world around us. Now it's funny that I was so thick because Jesus said it right out of the box, Matthew 5. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your lifestyle, your good works, and glorify or know God who is in heaven. And so when we're thinking about really influencing the people around us, we cannot think always in terms of assault. We have got to think in terms of exposure of our lives to the people around us, and thereby we penetrate a pagan society. Now our problem, many times the reason we're not effective is we try to make an assault where there's been no preparation. For example, well, I could go on and on in examples of this, but I think you were around, John, in California in 58 when Billy Graham had that crusade there. And a year later, our people did a survey on how the results were and whether they were staying or not. And if I'm not mistaken, 76% of those people, a year later, were still going on and tied into Christianity. But then right after that, Billy Graham went to Germany. Same team, same message, same approach, a lot of decisions. A year later, 1% was still around. What's the difference? Well, some places you're ready to reap. Some places it's not. Evangelism is a process and not an event. And we're only going to beat our heads against a wall if we only think in terms of assaulting, proclaiming the gospel, any chance we get. Now, we do that, but we don't count on that for our results because it just doesn't work that way. So tonight, I'd like to spend the time talking about what goes into this kind of evangelism, exposure evangelism. And there are three facets to this kind of evangelism. And we'll get into it. We'll move along as fast as we can. We have a lot of material here to cover. We've titled this the three-dimensional witness. And the first stage in exposure evangelism is the witness of the what? The thing that Jesus was talking about in Matthew 5, the thing that Paul was talking about in Titus 2. It's the witness of the life. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, yeah, I've got to be a good testimony. I've got to give up certain things and be very careful so that I reinforce the Protestant ethic among the non-Christians around me. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about here is that we have to be very careful to always be exposing our lives to the non-Christian. And I like to use the phrase aggressive exposure. Aggressive exposure. Because if you just go about your daily routine, you know, being a nice Christian and, you know, loving your wife and loving God and being nice to your children and going to church and everything else, chances are you're not going to be exposed to very many people. It becomes repetitious. And over your lifetime, you'll influence a small handful of people. And that's why Jesus, back in Matthew chapter 5, said something very interesting. Take a look at this. Matthew chapter 5. I want to call your attention to a couple of things here. But let's start at the end of the chapter and work backwards. Matthew 5, starting with verse 44, he says, I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, in order that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. Now look at this. For he causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good. Then he goes on. And he says, you do the same. Let your light rise on the evil and the good. The theme of this chapter is light. Let your sun rise on the evil and the good. And he explains how to do that. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Don't even tax gatherers do the same? See, what he's saying is don't stick to your own little circle, your own little clan, your buddies. When you think of having an evening of relaxation, or when you think about getting together with some friends, don't do like the tax gatherers or anybody does, which is just kind of invite your friends. But he says, deliberately break out of your circle. And he goes on, he expands on that. Look at the next verse. He says, if you greet your brothers only, what do you do more than others? What's he saying here? Be an affable person. Greet people that have never laid eyes on you. Go out of your way to expand your circle. Don't just greet the people that greet you. He says, don't even the Gentiles do the same? What he's saying is be friendly with everyone you meet. Now, in Luke 14, he says the same thing. He's telling a parable. And he's at a party, and he's talking to the host of the party. This is Luke 14, I think it's verses 12 through 14. You have to look it up. But what he says is this. He turns to the host, and you're supposed to be especially nice to the host, aren't you? But Jesus wasn't. He said, now, when you give a party, he says, don't do like you've done this time, inviting your friends and your neighbors and your relatives, lest they, next time, invite you back again. And you know how it goes. How many times does it come up in your household? Man, it's been 2 weeks since the Smiths have had us over. Don't you think it's about time we invite them? And so we keep this sort of check and balance system. And they invited us, now it's our turn. And now we've invited them. Man alive, they haven't called for 6 weeks. I wonder if we offended them. Pretty soon they go, oh, everything's all right. And so, you know, we go through life, and if we're lucky, you know, the day we die, it's 132 meals on this side and 132 meals on that side. Even Stephen, it hasn't cost us a thing. But Jesus says, don't do that. He says, when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, and the blind. Who are they? Well, when Jesus talks about the poor, the maimed, and lamed, and blind, he's talking about the non-Christian, the person who is in Satan's kingdom. So he says, constantly break out of your circle to draw people in. We take the initiative to expose our lives to people. We bring them into our lives. It's not the other way around. The problem with most of us is we're so psyched out on this separation thing that we live, wherefore come out from among them, and be isolated, saith the Lord. And so most of us don't even have friendships with non-Christians. And when we go out to evangelize, we jump out of our houses and run out and knock on the door of somebody we've never laid eyes on before in our lives and run back in and say, I did it, I did it. And the only thing we're interested in is being successful in doing it. But that's not what the New Testament says. It says open your lives to people. Expose your life to people. Be constantly at it. And if you're not constantly at it, you are not going to be effective in the world as a witness. That is a fact. But then we have the problem of non-Christians just not liking to be around us. We're so godly that they feel judged in our presence. All the while, I have something to say about that too. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, the handbook of anybody who wants to influence anybody. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, about six verses here which are really key to the whole thing. If you have a problem relating to non-Christians, take a good, close look at this passage. 1 Corinthians 9, 19 through 23. Paul says, though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all that I might win the more. And to the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might win the Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those who are not under the law. To those without law, as without law, though not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I am all things to all men, that I may by all means save some, and I do all things for the sake of the gospel. Good old wishy-washy Paul. What turns you on? I'm right with you. Oh, you don't like that? I'm with you. Oh, you're different. Well, I'll be different with you. He just kind of looked around to see what color things were, and he just painted himself the same color, and that was it. Is that right? That's right. That's what he did. He was free to do that. The problem is, most of us are so rigid that when a non-Christian comes around, we transmit the idea, the attitude, that what we're trying to do is reform him into our own image. And he's afraid of us because he's afraid that he's falling into the hands of a reformer. And we're asking him to do more than Jesus does to become a Christian. And so if we're going to expose our lives to people, and if they're going to want to be around us and get that exposure, we have got to, one, be aggressive, to draw people into our lives, and two, when we get there, when they come, we ask ourselves this question, and we're governed by it. What do I do to make this guy feel comfortable in my midst? How can I put him at ease? Let me give you an illustration of how this works. And usually, when it works, it's because it happens unwittingly. Mario Nietzsche is one of my dearest friends in all the world. I met Mario early in our experience in Brazil. I was translating for a lecturer at the university, and Mario came up afterwards to debate with this lecturer. And so, of course, the lecturer spoke only English and German, I guess it was, and Mario spoke only Portuguese. And so he began to discuss with this lecturer. And so he'd say something, and then I'd say it to this lecturer, and then the lecturer would say something back to him, and he'd say it to me, and I'd say it back to Mario. And so it was kind of like a ping-pong match for a while, you know, just, you know, passing it back and forth. And pretty soon, that just gets tedious. And so Mario and I kept talking. Well, out of that came an invitation to begin to study the Bible. And Mario accepted. Now, I didn't know it at the time, but Mario was a leader of a communist cell group. And I soon discovered that he was very, very turned off on religion. He was raised in the Catholic Church, and it was on the basis of, go to Mass, son, or you're going to perish in Hades. And he thought, man, if that's Mass, I'd rather have Hades. And that's the way he felt. He just checked out when he was about 10 years old. And so we'd sit down, and we went into the book of Romans, began to study it. And I found that I used the word God, or Christ, or the blood, or sin, or the cross, and you just see the color rise. And he'd be reacting. So we just changed our symbols. You know, God is, in Portuguese, is D-E-U-S, four letters. In English, it's three letters. We didn't feel God would mind, and so we changed it to one letter, X. And so we studied about X. And little by little, Mahdi began to believe in X. And he didn't perceive it, and I didn't tell him. But his communist cellmates did perceive it. And they would have hassles until 3, 4, 5 in the morning. And finally, he left the group in a rage and went and joined a terrorist movement. Well, we just kept studying through all this time. And he left the terrorist group in a rage one time because he made the mistake of inviting me along. And, you know, these terrorists thought, what in the world is this gringo doing in our meeting? And the next day he called and says, look, they said, look, Mahdi, you're invited not to come back. And that was it. And it was just the providence of God, because a month later the military came in and crunched the group. A lot of them were locked up, some of them tortured, some of them were still running for their lives. But God delivered Mahdi. Well, Mahdi and I studied the Bible for 4 years. And then he became a Christian. And he'd run me through all kinds of tests, and sometimes he wouldn't show up, and sometimes he would. And there's, you know, often there's just conflict when we'd be together, but always, oh, he'd always be coming back. And God really put the crunch on him when he did come to Christ. He was just in an impossible situation, an impasse where he could not go on. His career was at stake. He was he's a dentist, and he hadn't graduated yet, and it looked like he wasn't going to be able to, and it meant that he'd be in poverty all his life. And finally, one night, in a rage, he says, "Okay, God, I give up," and that's how he became a Christian. Well, Mahdi was in charge of the work in Curitiba today. And we were reminiscing about a year ago. And he says, "Jim," he says, "you know what brought me to Christ?" And I thought, yeah, 9,000 hours of Bible study. He says, "No." He says, about 2 years after we began studying, I was over at your house one time. And we were just, you know, going from here to there and stopping for something to eat and going to move on. And he said, "Your kids were kind of pushed out of shape." But he says, "I saw the way Marge related to those kids and how she related to you and how you related to her." He says, "I was engaged at the time." He says, "The gal I was engaged to was a witch. You know, she wasn't in the occult. She was just witchy, you know." Well, he said, "We fought all the time." He says, "I didn't think there was any point of breaking up because I'd never seen a marriage where that wasn't the case. I just thought all women were witches. And so marry one witch, marry another, doesn't make a whole lot of difference." So he says, "But I saw how what was going on in your household." And he says, "I asked myself, Mario, when are you going to have a relationship like that with your fiancé?" And he says, "I recognized that it was never." And he says, "So I decided then that I need to become a Christian for my own survival's sake." Boy, you know, here's this guy who has a bookcase as long as from here to the wall almost, full of everything that built the Western civilization. He's read it and assimilated it. Brilliant guy. When it gets right down to it and coming to Christ, the thing he's concerned about is not the high intellectual questions, but his personal survival. And that's why the witness of the life is so important. Because we are living in a world full of alienated people. Margaret Mead is trying to figure out an option for marriage because marriage never was a good idea, according to her. because it succeeds so seldom. And Toffler talks about, in his book Future Shock, how he wonders out loud how much stress man can take before he just goes wild. And he worries about the day when we go to bed, things are changing so fast that we're going to wake up some morning in a world that is different than the one we went to bed in. And we're going to go mad. And so the people around us, even though they look like they've got it put together, are living in desperation. And when we expose our lives to people, what we are saying is, look, there is hope. You can go about clothed and in your right mind in this mad, mad world. And that is the message of the life. And that's the only message that the truly pagan guy, the guy who doesn't have Sunday school and church in his background, is going to listen to. And they, by the way, are the majority here in the United States. What about the second witness? Witness of the body. You know, usually when we think of a guy that's a witness, the image of something akin to the Lone Ranger comes to our minds. You know, some guy that can draw on anybody he sees and always drills them through, and day by day comes home, you know, kind of blowing the smoke out of his gun and saying, well, I got another one today. And we think, boy, I must not love God, or maybe I don't read my Bible enough. And we're just defeated by the image. Where do we get that idea? That that's what a witness is. We don't get it out of the Bible. Evangelism is a group enterprise. It's not the job of the Lone Ranger. Now you find the apostles, men who have been given, you know, the spectrum of the gifts, and now and then we see men who reinforce this caricature. But that's really not what we find in the New Testament. Evangelism is a group enterprise. We work together on it. And each one, every person here, has a unique contribution that he can make in the process of evangelizing secularized man. But we wind up doing nothing because we think we have to do the whole thing. And that's just not true. Just for example, last night, or yesterday afternoon, a fellow here in town, I wonder if he's here tonight. Better check before I tell on him. But a fellow by the name of Oleg came into my living room. Oleg's a new Christian, been a Christian about 8 months, something like that. Maybe not that long, February, I guess, wasn't it, honey? And he's one of these guys that just has a tremendous personality and a tremendous gift. He's a winsome person. And he picked up a guy that was hitchhiking, coming down from Denver. And Oleg's wife is in another state right now visiting some relatives, and so he invited the guy to stay overnight with him. And they got into it. This guy's from California, a guy named Pat. And so Pat and Oleg were into the message. Well, Oleg's a brand new Christian and you know, doesn't really know how to lay it all out, but he does better than he thinks. So after talking to him for quite a while, they showed up at my house. And so we got into it. And I spent a couple of hours with them. Well, then they shoved on, and this fellow, very obvious that God is working in his life. So I called Dave Hicks a little while later. And I said, Dave, what are you doing? And he says, well, I'm playing Scrabble with Oleg and Pat. You see what I mean? You get a guy, and one guy contributes one thing, another guy contributes another, and we surround him. A lot of it depends on what our concept of the church is and what our concept of the group is, the gang. Look at Matthew chapter 16. This is a thought that I first heard from Lawrence Sanney back in about 1961, I guess it was, where in Matthew 16, verse 18, he says, "I say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overpower it." Now, there are two ways of looking, or two ways of envisioning the church. One is to think of it as an impenetrable fortress against which Satan will not prevail. Now, that's really a comfortable thought. Here's this enormous citadel, and Satan is out there trying to get in, trying to destroy, and we bring rescue people and put them in, and then Satan can't get at them. But what it says in this verse is that the gates of hell will not prevail against the church. And what we see here is that fortresses do not storm gates. The church is not an impenetrable fortress. It is an immovable force. It is on the move. We cannot get the world into the church. We keep trying, and we think that's the way to do it. But for one thing, it'll never fit. There are 3,700,000,000 people in the world. But you can always get the church into the world. And as I look at my New Testament, what I see, more than anything else, is that these bands of Christians were like guerrilla bands moving into society. And as they moved in, they infiltrated and influenced the people around them. When Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5, he says, "Now, no one, when he lights a lamp, puts it under a peck measure, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house." And so if you just happen to be, you a Christian, happen to be in the same vicinity with a non-Christian, like it or not, he's illuminated. And that's the way it is with the body. We go to where the light needs to be, as a body, as small nuclei of Christians. Now, the body is a powerful witness. In John 17, verse 21, Jesus is praying to the Father, and what he says is that the world has the right to judge whether the Father sent the Son or not by looking at us Christians to see if we love each other or not. And in another place, he says, "No man has seen God at any time. But if we love one another, God is manifest to them." Now let me give you an illustration of how this works. Down in Brazil, we had this bunch of new Christians. And they were having kind of a hard time getting off the ground and really influencing their buddies. They'd talk to them, and it was obvious that they were Christians, and they'd try to communicate. But they were just having a tough time really influencing them. So they came up with an idea, kind of a crutch to help them along. We decided that we'd conduct some open Bible studies. Now, an open Bible study is where maybe 15 people who are Christians will invite about 15 more people that they have been witnessing to. And then they'd come over to one of our houses, and often it would be on a Sunday morning, or it would be on a Wednesday night, or sometime when just kind of everybody was available. And so they'd come over, and one of the fellows, one of the new Christians, would take about 20 minutes to present something like, "Who is Jesus Christ?" or "What is the nature of man?" or "What is the Christian message?" Some basic idea to Christianity. And he'd spend about 20 minutes presenting it, and then there'd be questions and answers. And the discussion often got really pretty hot. But it was very interesting. And they'd go on for another hour and a half, something like that, and then they'd break off and have coffee and get the guitars out and sing. And they'd loaf around there for several hours, and then they'd trickle off, go back home. Well, then I began to notice that everybody that came to those things eventually became a Christian. And about the same time, Osvaldo came to me and he says, "You know, Jim, I'm not going to bring anybody to these meetings anymore." I said, "Well, why not?" He says, "Well," he says, "I really don't think it's fair." He says, "A guy comes and he becomes a Christian." He says, "I'm afraid that it's becoming a crutch for me. I don't know what I can do it without it." And I didn't have it put together at the time, but I said, "Well, Osvaldo, you just kind of keep cheating for a while, okay?" But then I began to hear the guys, all of them, saying the same thing. I thought, of course, it was the content, and I was kind of looking at the content, which wasn't all that great, and trying to figure out how the guys were changed just because of that content. But the guys began to go away, and they'd say, "Man, I haven't seen people like that before in my life. And I haven't seen a group of fellows like that before in my life. And I've never seen people like that before." And then it dawned on me that what was happening was the witness of the body, where these fellows were seeing the dynamic of Christians being together and the relationship that exists between them. And it's an irresistible force. And it's in this context that we come to the third witness, which is the verbal witness. Now, with the witness of the life and the witness of the body, by themselves, will never draw anybody to Christ. Because like it says in Romans 10:14, how will they hear without a preacher? You know, how in the world is it going to happen unless it's explained to them? And so there comes a time when we have got to articulate the message. Now I want to clear up something here before we go on. I'm not implying that we spend 6 months, exposing the life, and maybe 3 months, exposing them to other Christians, and then we present the gospel to them. I do not think in terms of a sequence like that. Rather, they go on simultaneously. And many times, it begins with the verbal. And when it begins with the verbal, then be sure that you quickly draw that person into your life. And be sure that you quickly expose that person to the gospel as it is lived, and not just as it is spoken. Now, when we're talking about the verbal witness, I think one of the problems that we have in communicating the gospel is that all we know how to do is talk about eternal life. We can present the basics of the gospel and say, "Now, you want to go to hell, do you?" "No." "You want to go to heaven, don't you?" "Yes." "Well, now, this is the way." Well, I read in one of C.S. Lewis's writings that he'd been a Christian for a year before he even discovered that there was eternal life in on a deal. He didn't even know when he became Christian that eternal life was a part of the bargain. The thing that people are trying to find is how to put their lives together right now. And the gospel speaks to that. And when we expose our lives and we expose them to the body, that is the message that they're getting. And eventually what happens? 1 Peter 3:15. "Be ready to give an answer of the reason that is hope of the hope that is in you with meekness and fear." Be ready to give an answer. Now, so what they're going to do is they're going to ask you, "Hey, why are you the way you are? And why are I the way I are? And why can't I be like you are?" That's what they're going to ask. Now, many times, it's hard to pick up the question. And you're probably thinking, man, if I have to wait until then to talk to somebody about Christ, you know, I'll die and never talk to anybody about Christ. Well, I'm not so sure. I think that if you expose your life to people, and you expose them to the body, that they will be asking the questions. But the questions will come in a form that you're not used to hearing. A guy will say, boy, I'm just not getting along with my wife. That's a 1 Peter 3:15 question. What he's saying is, how do you get along with your wife? Or he'll say, man, I'm scared stiff about my kids. I'm afraid they're getting into drugs. That's a yell for help. Or a guy will say, well, man, I can't hack my job. You know, it's day after day. It doesn't mean anything. Life's a mess. And what he's saying is, how come you've got it put together? Those are the questions that people are asking. But usually what happens when that question comes, we think, I wish I could get to the gospel with them. And so we just kind of pass off those questions. And when they say, well, how come you get along with your wife? You just say, well, you know, how can anybody not get along with me? You know, I'm so charming, so easy to live with. And so we miss our best opportunities because we don't know how to answer it. And I think that the most important thing in learning to penetrate the pagan world with the gospel is to be very careful in our study of the scriptures to harmonize our lives and our lifestyles with the Bible. Now, that's harder than you think. We all think that we're biblical. And we all think that the way we live is sort of the center of God's designed for Christians. But you know, our Christianity is heavily laced with the philosophy of the Industrial Revolution, with Cosmopolitan magazine, with the Women's Lib movement, with Madison Avenue, with Puritanism, and a lot of things which just really do not come from the Bible. And so, we have our Christianity over here, but our lifestyles are really not reminiscent of what the Bible teaches. And we need to be careful to go back and make sure that the way I relate to my wife comes from the Bible. The way I raise my children comes from the Bible, that I've learned how to raise my children from the Bible. That my self-image has come out of the Bible. That the way I use my time, the way I use my money, the way my values and everything else, they all come from the Bible. You see what happens then? No matter what subject you get into, whether it's business, money, what you do with your spare time, raising kids, if you're going to explain how you think, what are you going to be talking about? The Bible. And there you go. It's not that hard. Let me illustrate that, and then we'll close. Back in, I think it was 1970, 71, 72 it was. It just seemed longer. I was coming back from a conference here in the U.S. I'd been here 2 months, and had been in several conferences and been around quite a bit. And I'd come from the tropics and came up here to this barren wasteland, and I was having a hard time surviving. I'd caught a cold, and I'm sort of an insomniac, and so I was behind in my sleep, and so I was just generally pushed out of shape. I could hardly wait to get back home and just kind of lay down in the sun. And I caught a plane in Atlanta. I was going down to Fort Lauderdale, where my wife's family lives. And then the next day I was going to go on to Brazil. So I got on the plane, and I had a book with me. I was sitting in the aisle seat, and I always sit there. And there was an empty seat. And then next to the window, there was a gal, 24 years old. So I was sitting there with my nose in my book, you know, reading away, mainly in self-defense. I just didn't want to be bothered. You know, I was people up to here. Well, before we even got off the ground, the girl leaned over and tried to strike up a conversation. She says, "What are you reading?" And I said, "A book." And she says, "What's it about?" "Psycho-cybernetics." And she says, "Do you study psychology?" "No." So, you know, I was trying to turn her off, but she just, you know, kept asking questions. And, you know, I'd been going up and down, and my head was stuffed, and so I was half deaf. You know, everything goes out into your ears, and so it was really bad. So she was talking, and I sat over in the middle seat, and we began to talk. Well, we hadn't gone very far, and I realized that she was just in a flirting mood. And I've learned that the best defense for that kind of thing is a strong offense, and so I began to tell her about my family, my wife. And I began to tell her about my relationship with my wife, and began to describe, you know, what it's based on. And then I just leveled with her. I says, "Look, I travel a lot. Many times I'm alone and I'm tired, and there are a lot of opportunities and I'm tempted. But I said, you know, I would not submit. For one reason, is that my relationship with my wife is based on trust. She trusts me, and I trust her. Now, I could deceive her, and she'd never know, but I'd know." And I said, "Then I would have to begin to destroy that trust." That's what the Bible says in 1 Corinthians 6, where it says we sin against our own bodies when we commit adultery. And so I just began to describe to her why that's just not my lifestyle. Well, she sat there, and her eyes got bigger and bigger, and her mouth dropped, and she says, "I've never heard anything like that in my life." And then she began to tell me about her life. And I hear she is 24 years old, teaching school in Fort Lauderdale, and afraid to get married. You know why? Because she sees her married friends and see everybody cheating on everybody. And she says, "Man, I just don't think I can take that." And then as she went on and talked, she says, "Where did you get these ideas?" Because I hadn't told her I got them out of the Bible. So I says, "Well, you'd laugh if I told you where I got them." "No, I wouldn't. I just got them out of the Bible." Was that right? Then I went on and explained to her how I became a Christian and what it means to be a Christian. Well, about then, I was just kind of getting down to the punchline, and about then we landed in Fort Lauderdale. And I was a little bit, you know, unhappy because I didn't get to finish with her. So we landed and we got up and I let her out and let a few other passengers out, you know, between her and me, because I was getting off the plane and there, you know, would be Marge's family, and they'd want to know, "What's he getting off the plane with this gal for?" So we walked down the ramp there, and just as I was walking off, somebody grabbed me by the arm, and it was this gal, and she introduced me to about 10 of her friends, the friends that she was telling me about on the plane. And I stood there for several minutes as she described our conversation to those 10 friends. And then I walked away with a heavy heart, because I realized that if I just had a few days, I could change their night to darkness with the message that God has given me. Well, just a little sequel. It doesn't have anything to do with the message. But a year later, I was in church there in Fort Lauderdale with Marge's family. And sitting there, and lo and behold, in walked this gal and sat down right in front of me. And after the service, I got up and said, "Hey, I know you." He says, "Oh, yes." She says, "I'll never forget that conversation that we had on the plane that changed my life." And so I was just a part of God's program to reach this gal. But the point is this. You see, the gospel does not only speak to life after death. The gospel speaks to the death we're living in right now. And we need to learn to communicate it on that level. You see? But the only way that people will understand that the gospel speaks not to pie in the sky by and by, but to the needs right now, is to see that it does in the way we live. And we've got to expose our lives to people if that kind of thing is going to happen. Well, I've kept you too long, sorry. But it's taken me this long to wade through these ideas and try to get them communicated. Let's have a word of prayer.